When did you meet like Corsano? Because then that's a whole kind of wing of your musical past or whatever.
No, I'll say this. You know, the first gig I booked was at the fucking bowling alley.
Oh, yeah. Oh, amazing.
It was a band I had with Jake, John, and this guy, Sean Matteo, that I grew up with, who I was in my high school bands with. And I remember seeing Chris around and he was doing the monochromatic thing, you know, because he used to dress like all one color. And when I first saw him, I thought it was because he was a Domino's delivery guy. Because he had like all blue on.
Hi, this is Jack Callahan, and you are listening to 400 Floor. You just heard from Samara Lebelski and Bill Nace, two veterans of the East Coast underground music scene, and old friends who, after years of orbiting around each other, began recently collaborating as a duo. We talk about Samara's beginnings in the downtown bohemia of Soho in the late 1970s, her seeing a Clash at Bonds as a teenager, playing CBs with their band Of a Mesh, through the 90s and thousands playing in Tower Recordings, Hall of Fame, and the Sonora Pine. Bill went from a small town in New Jersey to planting deep roots in the Massachusetts experimental music scene of the late 90s, where he began long-term collaborations with both Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon, among countless others. This episode has been edited from the full conversation, which is available at 400floor.com. That's the number 400 and the word floor.com. This is 400 Floor. Let's go on and get into it. Hey, what's up, guys? Thanks for joining me on
my podcast.
Hi, Jack.
Hey. So I've known both of you for over a decade at this point. I think, Bill, I think I met you 13 or 14 years ago in Western Mass. And Samara, I met you probably 11 years, like 2011.
Sounds right.
Yeah, also in Western Mass. Yeah, I guess I'll start with you, Samara. What was your introduction to music, and how you have a pretty interesting history and a pretty special and unique upbringing in New York? And so I'm really curious to hear more about that, because you've told me a little bit about it, but I know it's pretty storied and pretty stuff of legend. So,
I was raised by kind of hippie, very political types down in Soho in Manhattan. My father was a visual artist. My mom liked doing a lot of reading. And they started me on violin when I was 5, and we lived in a massive loft, first on Spring Street, and then in 72 onward, we lived on Broadway between Nice. Broom and Grand.
Yeah. Wow, right there. That's amazing.
Right there, yeah. They had a pretty, I don't know, very social life, and it's interesting, Danny Cal passed away a few days ago. He was the guitarist for the Blues Project.
Ah, yeah, right. I saw that.
Yeah. And he had been the boyfriend of my mom's best friend for a while. And I remember he would come over and play guitar. And then, like, my mom's best friend would play, like, Diamonds and Rust, you know, some Joan Baez. But even then, I was just like, damn, this is really too precious for me. But, yeah.
New York from the start.
Yeah, for yeah. real.
I mean, oh, the hush, the quiet, the intensity, the depth. So, but they, they got me started on violin lessons when I was 5. And I did like a very typical New York City, like private lessons, but also like playing instruments in school bands and doing the orchestras that were part of the education system. And then but always wanting to do the band thing and always listening to the radio and being more into that stuff and going to a lot of shows.
Yeah. What kind of what kind of shows would you go to?
It depended on who I was just following around. In junior high school, there was an older guy who I befriended, and we went and saw like The Cure.
Amazing.
Yeah, in between Faith and Pornography over at what was then the Ritz.
Oh, wow. Yeah, where was that?
12th between 4th.
Right.
Between third and second.
Right.
Yeah.
That's Webster Hall now.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Yep.
Saw a lot of shows. The Stranglers there.
Cool.
Went to Danceteria. Saw a ton of stuff there.
Amazing.
First Fall gig. Wow. Sunday Night Bouton there. Yeah.
Amazing.
Did you ever see Madonna hanging at Danceteria?
Maybe, but not that I recall. It was all pretty fluid back then. Iggy Pop at the Peppermint Lounge, Cramps at the Peppermint Lounge, all around 82, 83. Sometimes some hardcore stuff. Went to a Black Flag. You get the Mud Club very early, 81-ish, I think. Bad Brains at Irving Plaza. Just loads and loads of stuff. And then started playing in a band, you know, I think around when I was 17, around 84, something like that.
Yeah, so what's up with that band? I think you've told me a little bit about that. Or maybe I've seen a photo of it online.
Is that of a mesh?
It is of a mesh.
Wow.
I met some like older hang around types at Danceteria, and they, you know, I think back then the whole thing was if you could play an instrument, there was no reason to not be in a band. It was just like in like that. So we did, and
back when you wanted to be in bands.
Yeah. It was also another gateway to like an older world. But you know, I read a lot of Forced Exposure at that point and like figured out like, all right, how you can do this and make it work, and would like bring boxes to the post office for distro, or Caroline Records was around the corner, would bring them a box every once in a while, and just consign actually at like Tower Records, weirdly enough, like they were the biggest seller of that stuff back then, you know.
How did you put on what medium, cassette?
No, two vinyl EPs.
Nice. I'm curious whether or not this makes the final cut or not. What was the process back then of actually making the records, like compared to now, which is...
I don't know. It seemed about the same, pretty straightforward. You know, we, in terms of recording, we went to Martin Beese's studio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Whoa, that's crazy. Cool.
Yeah, everyone was older than me in the band, and they were a bit more experienced, and our guitarist played with Glenn Branca. Her name was Ellen Watkins, and, you know, the musicianship level, you know, I think looking back was kind of high, and so they wanted to do a quality thing, so we worked with him, which was great. And he used to have this, like, couch with a slight alcove, and it was just all the records he'd worked on, which of course was very intimidating, but he's great to work with, of course.
Can you think of some of the record? Can you think of some of the prominent records that he has recorded?
Yes. I remember them well. There was like some Nona Hendrix. There was a lot of Bill Laswell. There was some Live Skull, some Sonic Youth.
For those who don't know in Radioland out there. Yeah. Legendary.
Yeah.
Engineer.
Legendary and wonderful, still going. So in terms of everything else, I can't remember how the layout was done. I feel like I did it by hand mostly. My mom was working at a magazine at that point, and I think she helped me out. Someone in her production department that helped me like get the final imaging ready for production. But everything seemed really easy. And you know, like just... like I said, like reading Forced Exposure, like it was pretty clear like who the distros were at that time. And
totally.
I don't know. It was just like an easy entry into like how to take care of that stuff. And back then, if you pressed 1,000, it was gone. Gone in a pretty short period of time.
Yeah. Amazing.
So,
it's another example of how things were a little different back then.
Now you just sit on those forever and end up throwing them in the river and
exactly.
Music.
You sit on, you make 100 and you're lucky if you get rid of them.
Yeah.
What did your parents think of this? Were they able to relate at like being at like artists, like to the sort of downtown, you know, underground scene? Were they able to appreciate it even if they weren't necessarily into the music? Like, were they able to appreciate it as like an artful thing?
It was a little tricky at first. They had a pretty tough time with the Teenage Rebellion. Like, they had been rebels, you know, they had been gone down to Mexico, you know, when I was just born to like do drugs and, you know, wear hippie clothes, whatever. But when my dark side came out, they really couldn't kind of deal, and it took them a long time to get a grip on it, which I was
so funny.
Right? The irony.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Wow.
But ultimately, like, you know, we played out a lot. We played at CBGB's a ton. We played at Danceteria. We played at Irving Plaza. And I think my parents, when they saw how much work I was putting into it, really, really kind of came around and were very supportive.
That's great.
Ultimately, yeah. I do remember, though, when the Clash played at those... at Bonds, like they did that series.
The series,
of gigs.
The legendary in like Times Square or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For some fucked up reason, my dad let me get online overnight. I just turned 14.
14? God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Little chicky. And they let me do it. And so I got to see a couple of those shows.
Yeah. So from there, how long did that band continue? How old were you when it started, first of all?
I was 17. I think I was 21 when I was like, no, can't do anymore.
Well, so yeah, what after the dissolution of that band, where did that take you?
I finished up college because
where
it was
did you
really
go?
I went to Hunter College.
Oh wow, nice. Cool.
Yeah. I didn't like it. I did not like it, but I did it for my mom, and she's left me the fuck alone ever since I graduated.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you finished, which is also, you know, not an entirely common thing in our community, you know.
That's right. Thurston said, like, what did he say? Like, graduating college is for losers, like real rockers don't graduate.
Damn it.
Yeah, too late.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I kind of like, you know, I fucked around New York, but it was like kind of like a weird time there. I couldn't like really find like people to play with that. I don't know. So I kind of split town.
This is like early 90s, late 80s.
Exactly. Yeah. End of 91. And that's when I met this band called Metabolismus. I split, went to Europe and met them.
That's like a long term collaboration
long,
for you.
Long, many ways. Like I've recorded almost every single solo record, partly or wholly, at their place, their studio.
They have like a crazy studio, right? Like in where are they based?
They're in this tiny village called Degenfeld, but it's outside of Stuttgart in the southwest Germany. They were just a big deal for me because it was like improvising or jamming in a rock context, which I hadn't. You know, like jamming not to write a song, but jamming as music in itself. And that was the first time I experienced that. So that was like mind blower.
Yeah, totally. Were they connected to sort of like a larger underground scene there?
I think, you know, there was a deep love among the whole crew for like 60s music. And I think that's because there was a real lack of stuff going on.
Right, like contemporaneously. Yeah,
the obvious reference is like 39 Clocks or something like that. But because of the there was an American base really close by, I think in Göppingen, and along with like the largest heroin problem in all of Europe, there was lots of records and American culture, and they were just all over that shit.
Wow. Yeah, I guess they probably go hand in hand sometimes. I don't know if that happens anymore with so much widely available culture online that's like so decentralized. Like that's a blast from the past that's how they got exposure in like the 80s or whatever, or even
totally
before.
A very particular thing. And also weirdly enough, they all really embraced like that thing where they're like anti-imperialism hadn't kicked in yet. Like Werner, one of their members, told me like they'd have German-American Friendship Day when the tanks would like roll through the town, and they were just like, yeah, loved it.
Wow.
Loved it.
Yeah. Again. Yeah. I guess it hadn't fully like rolled over yet into into our current moment. And then how long were you over there before you came back to the States?
First time was 8 months, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was just super turned on. Came back to New York. Started Pacer and then didn't start it, joined it or formed it with others and then did Hall of Fame. And
so
then,
wait, I actually don't know Pacer. What is Pacer?
It's just like indie rock.
Cool. Wow. Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. Cue a Pacer track and then to cut up.
A 10-inch, but the thing that was really interesting is we were good friends with James Murphy at that time, so we recorded at a very early version of his Plantain studio.
Oh, that's funny. I don't really know his history. That's cool. So, but this was like, this is mid-90s.
Yeah.
At this point, we're fully in the middle of it.
Yeah, maybe 92, 93. Yeah.
Right. Oh, okay. That's, I didn't realize like his sort of roots in that go earlier than I would have expected, to 92 or 93. That's cool.
Yeah, he had this band called Pony would play around.
Right, right.
And I thought they were very charming. I liked them early on, yeah.
Hall of Fame is probably one of the projects that you're best or most associated with. Could you talk about like how you got started?
I met Dan Brown via Pacer. He was in Pacer. And,
okay, cool. So the little bit of a precursor group.
Exactly. And we met via like this drummer, Laura Cromwell, who was really deep in that first wave Knitting Factory scene.
Cool.
But we really gelled. Always massive chemistry with that guy. And when Pacer broke up, we were like, I was like, let's do this. And really just clicked. Still does. We're still super tight. And then Theo Angel moved to New York and he joined and made it a trio.
Did you guys tour? I assume you did.
Not a lot. We went down to Virginia. The final tour was with Heathen's Shame and Double Leopards.
Yes. I just played in Providence a couple days ago and Greg rolled down. I hadn't seen Greg since he lived in Seattle for years.
Greg's the best.
Yeah,
he's one of the greatest ever.
Heathen's Shame's one of my favorite bands.
Dude, I was recalling seeing Heathen's Shame at the Hampshire Dining Commons in 2008, I think.
I was at that gig.
Yeah. What year do you think that was, the last with the Heathen's Shame gig?
2002.
Okay, cool. What year did you start Hall of Fame?
I'm pretty sure it's 96.
So you had a pretty decent run. And that's definitely like within that 6-year span, that was kind of the coalescing of like a larger thing, like U.S. music scene awareness.
Obviously, like Tower Recordings was a big one, but there were not that many like, I don't know, No Neck Blues Band was a big deal for me, but we, you know, we did shows with them or I'd set up shows with them. But it was, that was pretty disparate. But the thing that you were saying about the coalescing, like in 2002, part of that tour was the first Distill Fest.
Right. Okay. So I remember talking, this was something that I was like, oh, I kind of know a little bit about that. And I remember you saying this was the thing that connected all of these people. So yeah,
I'm incredible.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
So it was Distill and Freedom From. So you have Michael Yonkers, you have Double Leopards, you have Hall of Fame, you have
Son of Earth.
Shout out.
But you have
Hair Police.
Nautical Almanac, wow. Hair Police, Wolf Eyes, Charlambides. Yeah.
Were you aware of some of these other people you hadn't met from, you know, the Midwest or whatever, or from, you know, New England?
I was aware of everyone, but I hadn't met Charlambides before.
Yeah, which is a big, important connection.
Yeah, and I knew their stuff from Silk Breeze, obviously, but they were awesome. It really blew my mind. But prior to that, like it was actually the Amish record label that put together a night, and it was the first time like Tower Recordings and Hall of Fame played together. And we immediately bonded with Matt Valentine. And,
of course,
started working together. And that would have been like around 96 or something, a good bit earlier than the Freedom From Festival.
Hall of Fame and Tower Recordings started sort of around the same time.
Yeah, Tower, I think, was slightly older.
Okay.
They were, like, very well established. And I was always, like, an auxiliary member, and I always thought of their, like, real strength being, like, these three songwriters, but all having a love of similar music.
Who were those songwriters?
It was PG6, Ellen Rush, and Matt Valentine.
Yep, totally.
Yeah.
So then that Amish showcase, it was the first time you met those guys and played with Tower.
But they lived in like the next neighborhood over, so a lot of socializing, a lot of four track playing at home, a lot of—
Where did you live and where did they live? Maybe this won't be as interesting for everyone else, but I'm very curious about it.
I'm over on Ridge between Stanton and Rivington in the Lower East Side, and I've been in this neighborhood or the East Village since the late 80s, and I've been in the same place since the 90s. So, and they were over in the East Village, I think on 3rd Street. So just a short walk over.
At that time, so this is like 96, 97 or something. Did you feel like you were part of a larger context for the music that you were making? You did not. Cool.
Did not. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I said, you know, we found out about Tower, which we had a strong connection to, and there was like no neck.
But yeah, I think we
felt very isolated otherwise, which I'm going to defend as a positive, that it allowed us to just not be distracted by what other people were doing or desirous of what other people were achieving, and just allowed us to do our thing, which, you know, we set up a four track in one of the rooms in the place I still live in and just recorded constantly. And that's all we did.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, obviously there's, you guys were all, I mean, you all specifically, I know, but like, were aware of a sort of history of downtown New York music and scene. Did you feel like, you felt like you were kind of just on your own doing it, at least before meeting maybe Tower and No Neck, et cetera. But like, did you feel like there was a scene that existed, but you were like not a part of it, or like there was a larger scene or something that you didn't feel like you fit into, rather than just being like there being nothing and like you didn't have anyone?
I mean, the strongest connection I felt was obviously to Metabolismus.
Yeah, right.
And that was huge. But they were very isolated as well. I mean, obviously, it's a very social thing, but I think we were at that age where we kind of wanted to have blinders on and just do our thing. And I was not aware. I mean, even when we talk about the Freedom From thing, a lot of those bands, none of them are exactly the same. It's a pretty wide range aesthetic, you know?
Totally.
And what like brings them all together, you know, why those bands? I don't know. Is it open-mindedness? Is it an awareness of like music through the ages? I'm not really sure. But when we met Tower, that was a really big deal because it was a strong like, okay, we think the same and our approach is the same.
Yeah, musically. Totally. So like, I mean, Silk Breeze is obviously an important kind of touchstone there because you guys both had records out on that, and that was, I mean, they started and Tom started that in 90, 91 or something. Is that right? Does that sound right? Did that feel like there was some sort of thing there? I mean, I guess there was like, at that point, it would have been like the Shadow Ring, Dead Sea, it's, you know, et cetera. Like, did you feel like that was some sort of generating context?
Yeah. I mean, the big connection there was with On. Obviously, like, Marsh and I connected and stayed very connected. They also were, like, in that whole vibe. And she had been already, like, playing with Matt Valentine, Marsha Bassett, you know. And she befriended me pretty quickly. I think the first time we played Philly, or the second time, Hall of Fame did. That was definitely the first like opening up of things. But you know, then I also had like this other world going a little bit with like Sonora Pine and stuff like that, and doing a lot of touring with that. You know, there's this underground thing that we've been speaking about, and then there's this kind of other thing that's going on at the same time. That's still pretty underground, actually.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Maybe do you want to just talk a little bit about that since we haven't maybe really talked about that side?
It's just like Tara moved to New York and Tara Jane O'Neill, and because of Pacer, so the woman she was seeing at the time, Cynthia Nelson from Ruby Falls, was introduced to us because she thought I'd be good for Tara. And initially, we did like Dan from Hall of Fame play drums, and I played bass with her and Sean, even did a show, and just wasn't really clicking. And then I just like started playing violin, and then it was like immediately clicked.
Who else was in that band? It was he was in Lungfish, the guitarist.
Yeah, Sean Meadows. Sean and Tara's thing. And then Kevin, the drummer from Rodan as well.
Rodan, yeah. So that opens your story up to this like whole other wide, you know, mid-90s kind of scene or whatever. Bill, how did you get into music? What was your early experience with music, with your family, with everything? How'd you come around?
I think my story couldn't be more opposite. You know, she had so much access, it seems. And, you know, my thing was like more finding stuff. You know, I grew up with, my mom was a nun before she had me.
Wow. Okay, that's good. Talk about context. Yeah.
Yeah. For 5 or 6 years. Wow. And then my dad was in the seminary before, you know, they got together, and then they both left and got into education. My mom taught in like a pretty poor district in Jersey. And my dad, worked in a high school in Jersey. So
where in Jersey?
My mom was out kind of near Vincenttown, out near like Fort Dix Army base. And then my dad was in Mount Holly, kind of like exit 5 off the turnpike. So yeah, it's the same story every time, but I did an early musical experience was definitely hearing the Ad-Libs, Boy from New York City, in my Uncle Vince and Aunt Tisha's van up in North Philly. Yeah, I wasn't really exposed to much in terms of like family or like where I lived. You know, I didn't have a car until I was like 17, 18. So getting into Philly was like involved a lot of begging for rides or friends or whatever. And Philly wasn't like at the time great for all ages gigs.
Right. So because of your where in Jersey you grew up, Philly was the city rather than New York.
Yeah, my whole family's from Philly, and then I grew up kind of outside of it. So yeah, it wasn't like, yeah, pretty opposite from Samara's experience. Mine was more like finding, you know, I don't know, kind of little breadcrumb trails, you know, little pictures of bands in a magazine. There's something really great about not knowing exactly what something is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So I always liked music growing up. And then around middle school, I was starting to get into, you know, more like REM shit like that. You know, because I was from Jersey. When I was like 10, I liked like hair metal and shit.
Yeah, of course.
And then like
that shows.
Yeah. Yeah, duh.
Yeah, duh.
And then when I was 12, that started changing. And then another big moment was this kid, Charles Harper, his nickname was Fatih, and he came over with the first Corrosion of Conformity on cassette.
Yes, amazing.
And Takes a Nation of Millions.
Oh, yeah, amazing.
The way that that experience felt was kind of one that I would feel again over the next few years, where it wasn't like I heard it and was like, oh, I love this. I was like, what the fuck is this? And when you have that, your world starts getting a little bigger, you know? And I was like, I don't even know what this is, so I really have to engage with this. And then I had an older cousin who, you know, she got me into, like, Joy Division and shit, and that was huge. And she got me into Sonic Youth. And then through that, I just kind of, you know, once I had a few pieces coupled with, like, I started just sending away for catalogs all the time.
Yeah, totally. What catalogs would you get?
Definitely Discord, especially when you could send the extra 3 stamps in and get the illustrated catalog, which was all the photos. you know, noise catalogs, like very friendly and stuff like that, I would get. And I told Dilloy this recently, like I didn't know that like stomach ache was just like a bootleg thing. And I sent a fucking letter to that Mexican address on the records.
Oh my God. Yeah. There's like some small village or whatever. And they're
cause I had I like heard the Church Police 7-inch and was so I sent off for that and never got anything back.
I'm still waiting for that, man.
Yeah. I was like, what the fuck? But, and even like Matador at the time had a cool catalog because they carried a lot then. So you could, like a lot of the atavistic stuff that was a lot of reissues or, you know, I got a lot of like Sun Ra through that. So really just anything, you know, Smells Like Records, you know, because it was in Jersey. And that was another thing. There was did you ever hear this band Flowchart?
Sounds familiar, but I can't say I have.
They were actually from my town, which I think if you knew for me and my friends, it was absolutely mind-blowing that not only was there a band from our town, but that the guy ran a label. And it was just like absolutely mind-blowing. And he was more like on the other, like Jessamine and stuff like that, you know, like, but I ended up playing with them for a little bit. So like my first gigs in New York were with them, like at Brownies.
Wow.
We opened for Chris Knox.
Wow.
And then one with the Cocktails. I wasn't like a Cocktails fan, but it was the same thing with them. Same thing with like, I had this bass teacher at the time. All those people talked to me like I was like a person or a peer, which I think was like the most punk rock. Like I really got a lot out of that. And that was kind of like a huge, it made it feel like this kind of open thing and not... there wasn't like a lot of gatekeeper-y kind of shit in terms of that. And I was really into like hardcore at the time, but I didn't like, you know, whatever the current iteration of that, like in Jersey was, I hated,
yeah. It's like the youth crew, you know,
I hated that shit. It felt super jockey and lame and just didn't have whatever element, you know, and that could have just been me again, like projecting onto history. And
I mean, I think there's a clear division from 81 hardcore and like 91 hardcore, you know? Yeah.
And this guy played me a lot of shit I'd never heard, like played me Neu, Faust, all the krautrock shit when I was like 15. And it was like mind blowing. So I think this kind of thing developed where all the energy that I got from being in the punk and stuff like that, whatever the modern version of that was, I just thought was so lame. So I kind of ended up trying to find that in other places.
Totally. And totally. I think yeah. You already at that age, at like high school age, were like, this sucks. Like this is like,
yeah,
this version
like, this
of
sucks.
It is lame.
I don't like, yeah. Like I like Minor Threat, but I don't like whatever this shit is. I heard like my first noise thing and like Coltrane around the same time. And you know, things just started kind of like,
this is like, early 90s at this point?
Early to mid 90s, yeah. But yeah, I was in a couple bands in high school with the same group of people.
Were you sharing that with those guys, or was that more of a personal thing?
Yeah, I was sharing
it.
Were
they also were they getting into it also?
Here and there. I always wanted it to be noisier. I always wanted it to be more experimental. And my friend was like really in the pop. I heard like Beat Happening and stuff, and I was like, played it for him. I was like, dude, check this out. This guy can barely sing. Like, what the, you know? And he took the ball and fucking ran with it. He ended up making like a couple kind of like fey pop records for like Black Bean and Placenta. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
Remember that label?
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I was sharing it, but I think we were still, even that with that, we were like getting into different
sides of that.
It.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. And then in 95, I moved to Boston and met John Trzynski. I put up a sign looking for someone to play with and met him.
Wow. Yeah. That's so fucking funny. What brought you to Boston in the first place?
My friend was going and I had no fucking idea what I wanted to do, but I knew I just wanted to get out of Jersey. I didn't want to, I wanted to think about what I wanted to do somewhere else. And I just wanted to like experience some life and just get the fuck out. You know, I really didn't have it was a very like impulsive move. I really didn't have an idea. I did want to play music, but I wasn't convinced yet that was like something I could do.
Like a viable thing.
Yeah. So I was still hesitant about it, you know?
Wow. So yeah. So you moved. I guess.
I went to SF in between.
Oh wow. Damn.
Yeah.
How long?
I was in SF for a year.
Wow.
Boston was cool because not only did I work at Rounder Records, the label, but I also discovered Twisted Village.
I was about to say Wayne and Kate. At what point did you meet those guys?
I worked with this guy Christian, who was in this band Juno with Mark Orleans.
Oh wow! Oh damn!
Wow!
And they were a fucking great band, but like Samara was saying about Metabolismus, I was 18 at the time. And the band I was in Boston with John and a couple other friends were getting this idea of like wanting to improvise, but still in more of a rock context. And Juno just did that and nailed it. So they were kind of like a huge big band for us. And then, you know, dipping into Twisted Village was amazing.
Yeah, for sure. So then at that point, so this is like 95. So it was like, was Sunburn going at that point? Had they started yet?
Sunburn was going. Yeah. I don't know if it was still Shit Spangled Banner.
Oh,
Sunburn.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. They were going.
Yeah. Did you meet those guys then or did you later on?
Later on. Yeah. I met like Paul Lebrecht and Paul's brother. There was this other guy I worked with, Chris Lachatz at Rounder, who did that project Foom that had a couple things on Triple R. So he turned me on to some shit, but I would just go see anything I could go see. So like I saw Thinking Feller. I mean, I just saw so much shit up there. It was amazing. Then I moved to SF and that was, I don't think it was like till around Western Mass. Like I feel like everything pre-Western Mass was like kind of me just collecting ideas and shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't sure about it. I was like kind of uncomfortable in my own skin. So SF, I wasn't making any music. I moved out there on the bus with a bag
God
of clothes.
Damn.
That's it.
Oh God, that's brutal. Fuck.
Then I came back to Western Mass. You know, my friend was living there. He's like, come back. Well, you know, I had lived in Olympia for a summer and it was the first time the idea of a small town was ever appealing to me. And my friend was in Western Mass and was like, come back. We'll get a basement. We'll play da 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 da. And then that's how I came back to Western Mass. And even that, the beginning of that was like, I was playing a lot. Things were cool, but it wasn't until I moved to England for a year that I got kind of like, I don't know what the word is, but I came back from England just kind of like ready to fucking go and really like just full fucking in, fully committed. Like not only is this what I want to do, but this is how I want to live. I think a lot of that was like, you know, I met up with Dylan and Karen. I actually lived with them for a little and they're like you know, they were just so supportive of, you know, I started drawing when I lived over there. I'd never drawn before. And, you know, it could just be the most ridiculous thing. And they're like, yeah, cool. Keep doing it. You know, it wasn't
amazing. Yeah.
And I think I needed that just to like let the fucking steam out a little because I didn't really have, there was no precedent for, you know, there's no one in my family that was doing music. There was all this pressure of like, I'm doing this thing that, you know, maybe I don't even know if I'm allowed to do or whatever. I needed that a little to just kind of like just say fuck it. And then when I got back from that was kind of like I was like, all right, let's go.
What years to locate this in the history? What year did you move to SF? And then
SF was like 97, 98. I moved to Western Mass in 99.
Yep. And then you moved to England a year or two later.
2002, yeah. Okay. Yeah, right, 2001, right. 2002.
Totally. So then, and then you moved, you were there for a year and then came back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you moved to Western Mass, so this is obviously for me, this is of personal interest because, we met each other when I was at Hampshire College as a freshman in 2008.
Right.
And sort of knowing kind of, it was this storied place, you know, Thurston and Kim bought place there in the early 90s, mid 90s?
99.
Well. Oh, wow. Oh, okay. Wow. I thought it was a little earlier.
Went there in like 99, 98, 99.
Yeah, totally. What year did Corsano start?
98, I think. 98. Wow.
So, yeah. So he's early. That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but how long, and had Byron been there for a while?
Or Byron may have been there earlier because I think he talked, not talked, but I think he kind of was like, pitching the idea of that area for Kim and Thurston. I think he had already been there for a while.
He'd scoped it out. And then, of course, the originator in many ways, Jay, who grew up in Amherst.
Yeah, to me, I see that as like a... I do think there's overlap, obviously. But, you know, when I moved there, meaning now, yes, I think there's a thread there between this weirdo thing. But when I moved there, it was like kind of the... remnants of like Dino Pixie stuff. Like it was like kind of just bar bands and shit. There wasn't a lot of like the scene that's there now really didn't exist.
Yeah, totally.
It really was like a
stuff
lot
that wasn't
people,
bands, not band rock music or whatever.
Yes, like yeah. People, it was like all these people moved there at once and the scene just kind of sprang up. It was pretty...
That's really interesting.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, maybe we talk about that for a little bit. You being there and sort of like having moved there initially at the sort of beginning of that movement, maybe like what did you see being like the catalyst for that? Or just like why did so many people move there?
I think it was just slow going. I mean, without putting my own, in some ways, it's a very easy place to live.
Yeah, 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 for sure.
And, you know, obviously the school thing.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
People are there.
There's
for
a constant influx of kids,
yeah.
And people, artists coming by, and like.
To me, it was also a lot of threads coming together at once. I think from the outside, there's this notion that because Kim and Thurston lived there, that was a. But
they were the primary driving factor.
Yeah, but that's not personally how I see it. Like there were so many other things already. You know, like you had like Matt Weston and Helen and all them book and Cooper booking it, Old Flywheel. And then you had Matt and all them doing Hampshire. And so it was kind of all the, because when Kim and Thurston first moved there, like they, you know, they would kind of dip their toe in. It'd still be awkward at a gig because everyone would be like trying
oh my God,
to pretend
yeah.
they didn't know it was, you know, but it'd be like, ugh.
Yeah, totally.
And then everyone kind of, you know, it just got comfortable. It was like, whatever. But it was like, there were a bunch of people already kind of doing their own thing. And I think it was more all of that shit kind of all coalescing at once.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I forgot that, you know, of course, Chris Cooper and Jess Goddard from who both played in Carolina in
and Deerhoof.
The 90s. And Deerhoof, of course, like founding members or whatever. That's a whole other thread. Like, did you hadn't, I'm sure you probably didn't meet them in SF. I don't, they might have already moved at that point too.
They had already moved. Yeah, right, no, but right, I met, right. It's weird because I met Chris and Jess pretty early on through, not even through music, but through someone I worked with at the movie theater because I used to work
oh,
at
wow.
Pleasant Street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, crazy. Yeah.
And I remember Chris, Jack was like, oh, Chris plays guitar too. And Chris was like, electronics. And I was like, oh.
Oh, okay. That's cool. That's great.
But yeah, to me, it was more about a bunch of things coming together at once. I do think those guys doing Fatworm, in my mind, to me, was there was something like really congealing about that.
That's really cool to hear because that was how I remember I played my high school noise rock band played with Fatworm in 2007 before I got into Hampshire and I was like
yeah.
I think I want to go to Hampshire and they were like dude come, you should do it for sure
yeah
and like being like oh like. I loved that band. I loved Fatworm
oh,
at
great,
the time.
Great band.
Fucking great band.
Yeah.
That was like, yeah, for me personally, that was like a huge thing. Aside from knowing like, oh, Thurston's there. Like,
yeah, there was a lot of other, you know, and same with, you know, Chris and Paul, you know, and then me, Jake and John started doing XO4. So I think there was like a lot of stuff like that at once of just people just kind of really just like throwing down and being like, you know, in Son of Earth. And each thing kind of was its own thing. I mean, that's one thing I love about Western Mass, and I would leave this to Samara, but I think New York has a bit of this too, if only by default because it's so fucking big. But no one really does genre in Western Mass. Like even the even the noise stuff, it's not like a tabletop noise guy, you know, pumping his fist in the air, and but nothing wrong with that. But it's like whether they want to do it or they just can't do it, but yeah, there's not really a genre thing in the scene there, like across the board, the noise stuff, the bands, the folky stuff, whatever, which I think was like huge for me. Like it finally was like, okay, this makes sense. This is cool. You know,
I was going to say Byron was like a really big deal because people knew he was doing like bootleg records. Like he does that early No Neck record. But the legend of the store was a really big deal for New Yorkers because he was such a head, you know? And he, for a lot of us, he symbolized Northampton. And
yeah,
Yod was like, what is this? And you need to make an appointment. Like the idea of making an appointment to go to a store, you're like, what? I mean, I remember early on going there. There was a Dunkin' Donuts on King Street, and it was the only old one left.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it always made me think of that old Black Flag photo where they're sitting in the Dunkin' Donuts, but it still had that old diner counter. And we used to hang out there at night. And I remember walking in there once and just hearing this voice like talking about Stooges demos.
And you're like, there's only one person this could be.
And it was Thurston. I remember he had like a suit jacket on with like the elbow patches. And we were like, what the
college
fuck?
College Thurston, yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Hall of Fame played at Yod in 2002, and he made us play in front of this massive wall of records, and you just felt like the like weight of musical history was going to fall on you while you were playing.
Physically and emotionally or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it was a lot of stuff, like I said, a lot of stuff at once. It was like Yod, Hampshire, anyone else doing house gigs. Also, all those Actuel records we're starting to get reissued at that point.
Yeah, right. That was when the whole reissue series,
which
yeah,
was
totally
huge for me. Michael Ehlers was doing Fire in the Valley.
Yeah, right. Of course.
Which were, you know, the only other place you saw those gigs were New York, maybe. So to me, it was like a lot of things at once. And then how that inspired people to kind of like do their own, you know, well, I'm going to have my, you know, I had the 11s thing for like almost 2 years.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So-and-so classic had this over here, you know. And everyone kind of was like inspired to kind of have their own little corner of that. But to me, they all kind of like existed in relation to each other.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, 100%. Which was kind of like,
but no one was doing the same thing.
Right.
No. And that's always what I, you know, I was like, I always wanted a context. I didn't necessarily want to be part of a scene per se, but I think having a context like that, I was always reading about punk and hardcore when I was younger. I think the regional aspect of it was always so exciting to me,
for sure.
And 100%. I think moving there and getting to kind of like experience a bit of that, and a lot of it pre-internet, I think was like
it's definitely, you like can't buy that shit, you know.
Yeah, yeah, like that place is like what I do is like totally kind of inextricably linked to that place.
How did you find your first gigs, like going to shows in Western Mass? Like, first of all, what were some of the first like weird shows that you saw in Western Mass?
Fuck. I mean, there was definitely a whole scene that was still kind of like a slight leftover. We were talking about like 90s bands, but kind of like mixed with weirder stuff. So there was still like a lot of like house shows that would have that. The Hampshire thing to me was like a little more focused.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, I can tell you the first show I booked there, which was my friend Jason that I told you did the record on Black Bean and Placenta.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then I want to say it was Magic Marker's first or second show.
Wow. When they were
called Black and Blue Magic Markers, and it was just the Lisa and Pete duo.
Wow. Yeah.
And I remember they set up all this shit. You know, I was psyched. It took forever to set up. You had like a vacuum tube with like this suitcase and shit. And then they played like 5 minutes and I was like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah.
I felt like I had all this time to fill and I was like, holy shit, you can play longer if you want. And they're like, nah, that's it. And then I think John and I played duo, and that was like XO4 as it was a duo first.
When did you meet like Corsano? Because then that's a whole kind of wing of your musical past or whatever.
No, I'll say this. You know, the first gig I booked was at the fucking bowling alley.
Oh, yeah. Oh, amazing.
And it was a band I had with Jake, John, and this guy, Sean Matteo, that I grew up with, who I was in my high school bands with. He lives up in Rhode Island now. And I remember seeing Chris around and he was doing the monochromatic thing.
Oh, and, whoa. That's,
you know,
so
because he used to dress like all one color.
Yeah,
and
when I
first saw him, I thought it was because he was a Domino's delivery guy. Because he had like all blue on. But I used to see him at Hugo's all the time playing pool.
Yeah.
Oh, so we ended up just shooting the shit with him and asked him to play this gig that we were booking. And he's like, yeah, what do you want? You want me to do solo? I was like, yeah, whatever. So it was like him, Paul, and he's like, yeah, book it as me and Paul Flaherty and Mirror More. And we were like, you know, I was thinking of like the Sister record where it says Mirror. And I was like, that's fucking Thurston. And I remember Thurston had a Seals and Crofts shirt on, which I thought was so, I was like, what? And
man, that's classic.
That may have been the first gig that we all booked as a band and then where like, we were kind of interacting with him, and then him and John T started playing a little together. And then me, John T and Pete Nolan were jamming for a bit. That was called the Stabs. We only did one gig with Stabs. That, but we played a bunch.
Cool. Yeah.
And then out of that, Chris and I started playing duo.
Oh, amazing. When did you guys meet each other? Do you remember that?
Me and Samara.
Yeah.
We were debating this recently. I say it's the Ecstatic Peace Showcase at South by Southwest.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Wow. What year was that?
I don't know, but I distinctly remember Bill during the sightings set.
What was I doing?
You were enjoying it.
I was always getting a pit going for sightings, like the only guy.
Oh, dude, the best band in New York.
I love those guys.
So was he? So the Ecstatic Peace Showcase, or what? Or was there another potential option?
I thought it was that, or I thought, okay. There was a weird time where I was like, not really living anywhere, and so if I was in town, Thurston would let me stay at their place, and Samara was there, I think, working on something with him, and I remember we watched the movie together. To me, that was like, whether it was the first time we met, I do think it was like the first time we hung out.
Yeah, we watched the Holy Modal Rounders documentary.
Yeah, classic. Amazing.
And then I can't even remember, though, the first time we played was...
Yeah.
I think it was that recording in Thurston's basement. No? Oh, wow.
Whatever happened with that?
Justin has them.
We did a trio opening for Lou in Northampton.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yes.
We got applauded off stage.
It was terrible. Truly awful.
People were like done with it and they were just like,
oh, that's so the most humiliating way. It's worse than booing.
Yeah.
The clapping over
Who
you.
Can't, Lou oh. liked it. Lou oh, came yeah. out and he just said, I really like that kind of stuff, guys.
I've done that before.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And Jake was there in the audience and I came out and the guy next to Jake was like, what is this, Thurston's fucking autistic friend?
It was truly awful.
No.
It was just.
Wait, where was that show?
The Calvin.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
Or no, Academy of Music? No, the Calvin.
Yeah, right.
But man. I don't even remember when the first duo gig was.
Yeah.
Well,
you guys have had a duo for a while you guys have been playing, doing stuff as a duo for a while.
We've been playing together, but I think the duo was when I got back from LA, so like 8 years ago.
Oh, okay. So not as long as
so we've been playing. Yeah. We've done more gigs before then, but I think the duo thing was more like when I got back from LA, so like eight years around.
I'm not sure what Thurston's motivation was, but he did a few shows as a quartet with me, Bill, Mary Lattimore, and him, and we did like Philly, New York. Where else did we do, Bill?
Philly, New York, and didn't we do three of those? Oh, Northampton. One was at my 11s night.
I don't know. I always wondered if it was a way of like breaking Mary into improv because they were straight improv.
I also think it was like, I have to think that because, so we had those gigs. So Thurston and I played some show in Manhattan to kids. It was like to little kids. It ruled. And Mary was set up at the door playing. as the kids came in, she would play. And then we
amazing.
Played. Yeah, and there was a point where we were sound checking and she was just playing, I think, and no one was listening to each other because we weren't playing together. And it sounded really cool. And I think that kind of planted the seed. But then it was weird because we went to do those gigs, stopped at Feeding Tube when it was on King Street, and Maloney was there. And Maloney ended up just hopping in with us for the gigs. And then that pretty much became, minus me, but that pretty much became the band for... So I have to wonder if...
Because
Thurston's always the gears are... I wonder if that was a way to like road test... I don't know, like you guys hanging out or playing or whatever the fuck. Because it was pretty soon after that became the band.
That's really interesting.
Well,
that's
I'd already been working with them on the previous record.
Right. Was that Trees Outside the Academy or was that the one before? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting though because that's around, that's my intro also because that was the band that I started doing sound for. That's how Maloney roped me into that and was like, you want to go on tour with us?
You did the Demolished Thoughts band?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah. 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 I did the last tour with Mary.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah. Obviously we've been sort of mentioning Thurston and Kim the whole night, or the whole day. It's still day somehow. But that's obviously like a big, huge part in all of our lives.
But it is the thing that connects us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Totally. Yeah. Totally.
And me and Jack.
Yeah.
I like to think we would have played anyway.
Yeah.
I like to think so too.
I'm sure that would have happened. You guys, no doubt. Just with even just what you guys do on your own or with other people, it's like a very natural, to me, it's a very natural pairing. Well, I'm curious, Bill, like, sort of talking about the Sonic Youth connection. I know the sort of the Thurston connection, but how did you and Kim start playing together, actually?
Kim and I start... Oh, God, I'm trying to remember. I do remember the first time Thurston introduced me to Kim, which was at the Red Barn, and I think it was one of the Glad Tree Fests. And he was just like, oh, have you ever met Kim? And I was like, no. And then he just walked away.
Oh, yeah. Sparks
so
fly.
It was like two shy people like just sit. And she had a flask and was like, do you want a sip of whiskey? And I was like, yeah.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
And then we kind of became friends. Like, we just kind of became friends first. Like, I remember we went to see fucking It's Complicated with Steve Martin.
Wow. Yeah.
Meryl Streep or something. Like, in the movie theater, like a matinee or some shit. Like, so we kind of started just hanging out first, then I would go over there a lot to hang, and then, you know, everyone says this, like, oh, we played and we didn't think it was for anyone, but we really weren't. We would just play in the basement and press record and didn't really think of it as anything. And, you know, we did it. Do you remember Sarah Jaffe lived in Western Mass?
Oh yeah, totally.
Like, I used to do shit. I did gigs with her.
Yeah.
We played once, the three of us, so it was kind of just shit, like, super loose, right? Like that,
totally.
And then me, Kim, and Thurston started doing trio gigs.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There. So it'd be like Mirror Dash with me.
Mirror Dash, yeah.
Just Northampton Wolves with Kim or, you know, whatever. You know, we just like playing with each other in the basement and shit. And she had a gig in France, like in Paris. Or no, before that, sorry. Before that, Thurston found one of those tapes we had done in the basement and thought it was Leslie Keffer. And wrote her and was like, oh, man, I really like this new tape. And she's like, oh, cool, you're okay with like all the beats and stuff?
He's like,
And he's like, what? Beats? What are you talking about? And it was us.
That's
so we ended
so
up coming
funny.
Up with a band name for it and all and whatever. And then fast forward to the thing in Paris. And so that was like the start of it. And then it just kind of snowballed from there, but really became a band on the road because the thing in the basement was so loose with no, really no sense of identity whatsoever that it really, you know, I'd be curious to hear some of those shows from that first tour on the 2 weeks. Cause I'll bet some of them are like, whatever. And maybe some are cool, but it really was like really became a band on tour and like really trying to, you know, it was cool. You really learn fast what works and what doesn't.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, a tour is like the road testing something is really the, no matter how much shit you do at home, it's road testing.
Well,
the
we
only
didn't
way.
Have that. We didn't have that time where you get to get in your own head and have this idea what the band should be and all this shit.
Yeah, it's just whatever works. I mean, you got to conceptualize it to some extent, but it's like, it's just what works.
Well, still
works.
Us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that was kind of the first, and then it just snowballed.
Yeah.
From there, we were like, let's make a rep. But
totally.
There were really never plans per se. You know, it was just like anything. Like
It happened and it worked. It worked well enough on tour.
Yeah,
that
like let's do a record. Yeah. Let's tour more. Let's do another record. You know, kind of like anything else that I've done.
You know what? I think we got everything we needed. Dude, thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. I'll talk to you guys soon, and I'll see you in the emails.
Kind of like anything else that I've done.
You know what? I think we got everything we needed. Dude, thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. I'll talk to you guys soon, and I'll see you in the emails. Thanks to Samara and Bill for joining me to speak about their lives and work. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to 400 Floor wherever you get your podcasts. To hear the raw and uncut version of this episode, plus much more bonus material, you can purchase it at 400floor.com. That's the number 400 and the word floor.com. 400 Floor is a podcast produced by Nina Protocol, where two musicians pair up to talk about their roots individually and together and reflect on the communities that shaped them. We'll be back in a few weeks with another deep dive. Thanks for listening.